multiple firms. So this really is a situation where if this case is dismissed, that I think that's why they're fighting so hard, because this may well be the end. And the courts have said, that's why I think the courts have said that the non-pendency of another case is a near controlling factor against the forum non-convenience analysis. Is there any other questions I can answer?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you both. The court appreciates your argument. We will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.
Please rise.
Please the court, Richard Abbott, counsel for appellants. Your honors, my clients are the four non-settling leaseholders at issue in this action, which revolves around a community known as Lindley Village that is an 87-lot mobile home park on Waits Creek, northwest of Ocean View. From our perspective, we believe the case also revolves around the issue of fair market value, and the value in particular as of the lease termination date. There are a few important facts. Starting out in 1988, when the leases were sold, 99-year leases, which are typically equivalent to a deed, but obviously it is a lease regimen. The next relevant date, although there was over a decade of litigation in the Court of Chancery over the maintenance and upkeep of the community, we believe is in February of 2003, when the plaintiffs below filed an action seeking enforcement, in their opinion, of prior court orders. That was followed shortly thereafter by an attempt or an effort by the owners to terminate those leases, which was ultimately successful. However, the Court of Chancery conditioned that lease termination on the payment of compensation, which there's a number of different references to what that compensation should be, but in effect, they all stated that they should be for the remaining term of the lease. Now, the court did not terminate the leases at that time. The court determined that the termination date would be at a later date, referred the matter to the Master in Chancery, specifically for the purposes of hiring an appraiser to value the leasehold interests. That was done. Lawrence Monahan was agreed upon by the parties to be that appraiser, and in that order that was consented to by the parties, it was expressly stated that fair market value would be the standard for valuing the leasehold interests. In addition, Mr. Monahan's appraisal report expressly states that his conclusion is based on the standard of fair market value. Now, the Vice Chancellor also confirmed at an office conference that preceded a rule to show cause hearing that is at issue in this case to my clients, specifically that his prior order had assured them payment of fair market value. As I've noted in the briefing, it's essentially assumed when you hire an appraiser in Delaware that the end result of that analysis will be fair market value as a result of the requirements of Delaware regulations governing appraisers, as well as the fact in this instance that an order specifically said that the uniform standards of professional appraisal practice should be followed, which call for a determination of what's called in the appraisal field market value. But when you review the definition, it is the functional equivalent of what the courts in this state recognize as the legal standard for fair market value. The opponents argue either equitable compensation or a suitable compensation mechanic was the standard. We don't find any evidence in the record that that's what the court intended for the reasons I've just stated. But also, as I noted, the term equitable compensation only arises in the very final order entered by the Court of Chancery that was drafted by opposing counsel that I expressly objected to because I did not believe it reflected a fair market value standard that had been established. Because this is a legal principle, fair market value, as recognized by the courts in the past in the fields of property tax assessment, condemnation, and breach of contract for sale of real estate proceedings, the issue before the court in our belief is one of law, and therefore the standard of review should be de novo. In fact, this is somewhat of an unusual procedural posture in that this matter was originally submitted to the master pursuant to, presumably, the rules 135 through 144 referral process in the Court of Chancery rules, and it was then stopped at the draft report process and converted into this sort of hybrid rule to show cause proceeding. And that segues into why this is not an action subject to the abuse of discretion standard. And the reason for that is that that standard, while applicable in class actions, shareholder derivative suits, and proceedings to value stock, statutory appraisal proceedings, if you look at those rules and that statute, they all expressly grant the Court of Chancery discretion, and logically, therefore, the exercise of that discretion would be reviewed in this court under an abuse of discretion standard. No such rule or statute applies to the court's determination of the value of the leasehold interests. In this case, the rule to show cause itself essentially established that the hearing was an evidentiary one, that there was certain evidence that would be taken, and additional evidence could be submitted, which we did. The end result of all that is what we believe is unrefuted evidence that there was a substantial increase in market values in the relevant marketplace up until July of 2005 even, and every indication based on the past history reflected in Mr. Monahan's appraisal that that type of substantial beach market value appreciation would continue. And of course, that comes into play because in the court's final order, the termination date of the leases is established for 3 months from today, or June 1, 2006. Now, there's some possibility it could be extended, but assuming all approvals are received, that would be the termination date. That's the date of value, and that's the type of principle that the courts of this state have followed in the condemnation context, the tax assessment context, and in the award of contract damages. There has to be a date certain for the effectiveness of the fair market value analysis. You can't sort of set a date and then let that necessarily be the value 2 years later. In the condemnation context, it's the date of taking, which is usually the date of the entry of the order of possession. In the context of tax, property tax assessment, it's the statutorily established date and year of assessment. And in the contract damages context, it's the date of breach. So in this case, we believe it should be the date of the termination of the leases. And not only does case law indicate that that would be the appropriate date of value, but in fact, implicitly in the Court of Chancery's decisions, that is proven. In other words, Court of Chancery said that my clients and other leaseholders should be paid for the remaining term of the leasehold.
Well, in this case, if your position prevails, do you contemplate that your clients would surrender the land in June and then the proceedings would go along independently, much like a condemnation, and then someone would just figure out what the value was in June, even if that determination was made 6 months later?
Well, it would have to be made on or about June 1st to determine what the market conditions were, excuse me, Your Honor, on June 1st. However, given the fact that, at least in my experience, appraisers are typically able to update appraisal reports.
No, I understand logistics, but you're making an analogy to condemnation, and in condemnation, the state gets the land, and you figure out the value later. And it seems that your real concern here is picking the date, and you're saying the date should be June. And my question is whether they get it decided June the 15th or December the 15th. Consistent with the argument you're making, if you prevail, do you agree that your clients would vacate the premises in June, subject to a determination as quickly as possible what the value was in June?
Yes. And completing, though, the thought on what the court below had ruled, it necessarily follows that if the payment to my clients and the other plaintiffs is to be for the post-termination remaining term of the leases, that can only be determined as of or shortly after the date of termination. And so...
Now, when did your clients first hear of the June 6th, the 2006 date? In the order, or was that... As I understand it, the other people who aren't contesting agreed to evaluation in 2000 as of a 2004 date. Is that correct?
That's correct.
They stipulated to an earlier date. And so my question is, when did your clients hear about 2006 as a date?
Well, let me just correct what I said a moment ago. The 2004 date was not expressly agreed to by the other plaintiffs. A June 1, 2006 termination date was consented to in the settlement agreement that they agreed upon in or about May of 2005.
Did the amount that they settled for take into consideration that the termination date was June 2006?
I don't know. You'd have to ask counsel for the plaintiffs.
Was the number higher than the appraisal?
The number was the higher of the two numbers in Mr. Monahan's appraisal. He concluded $145,000 as is, given the condition there were some problems at the site, at the park, or $160,000, assuming, as the Court of Chancery ordered him to, that the park was in a state of good repair.
But then the settlement was above that by $15,000, isn't that correct?
Well, the settlement was the higher of the two numbers at $160,000, and so since it assumes a good state of repair that didn't exist, arguably it was $15,000 more than as is, certainly. But
they agreed to that number, were they agreeing on the value as of the date they reached a settlement, or were they agreeing that as of the termination date of the lease, that represented fair market value for settlement purposes for their property?
I can only surmise that they compromised their claims and agreed to accept that amount. Certainly, we don't think that that's reflective of what the fair market value would, in fact, be in the marketplace in 3 months from today.
Have all those people been paid, all the other people except your four clients? Are they going to be paid in June?
It depends on the outcome of this appeal. No payments have been made because the settlement agreement expressly put everything on hold pending appeal. But I assume if this court were to affirm the decision of the Court of Chancery, then, and it did so before June 1st, things would probably be able to pick right up and complete. If the court does not do that, there's a question. I think it's a gray area. If this court were to hold that my clients are entitled to the fair market value, the next question that may arise is, where does that leave the other plaintiffs?
My question was following up on the Chief Justice's question. When everybody except your clients agreed to a number, did they always contemplate that they'd get their payment in 2006?
The settlement agreement called for a payment of $10,000 in September of 2005 with compensation to be payable, I believe, on or about June 1st, 2006.
Now, is a component of fair market value still what a willing seller is willing to sell for and a willing buyer is willing to pay?
With no compulsion on either party to buy or sell, correct.
Did the Vice Chancellor at all rely upon the figure that 83 of 87 people determined to be a fair number as a component of fair market value?
He pinned his decision on that, which is the settlement agreement number, and on the master's draft report, which had recommended $145,000. Of course, the master's report is relying upon Mr. Monahan's appraisal, which is dependent upon fair market value.
Yeah, so, I understand, but did everyone in reaching whatever basis they used in reaching their number for fair market value contemplate a June 2006 date as the termination of the lease and the time that value would be assessed?
The court below understood that, I know, because I argued that June 1st, 2006 would the value we believe would be substantially higher than $160,000, and we felt we were entitled to a value effective as of that date.
Well, I guess I'm not articulating my question very well. When the party settled, when the appraiser did his work, and when the master in chantry did his report, did each of the three contemplate that the property was being valued within the concept of fair market value as of June 2006?
The appraiser did not. The master did not. The settlement, they certainly understood they weren't going to get paid most of the money till June 1, 2006. What was in the minds of the other plaintiffs, I can't represent. But by and large, there was not an understanding up until this settlement was reached in the spring of 2005 that it would be as late as June 1, 2006 before the lion's share of the monies would be paid. I think everyone contemplated that there would be a master's process, which might take 6 or 9 months, to ultimately reach a final value conclusion and payment. But I don't think anybody ever believed in May of 2004 that it would be 25 months later before the money would be paid.
Did you want to save your rebuttal time?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. I'm Richard Fronta, attorney for the appellees, defendants below. We'll call the park owners for simplicity, as there's many appellee factions. Almost 12 years ago, this case began with Chancellor Allen exercising the power and discretion of the Court of Equity to craft a remedy to address the disputes which arose from what the Chancellor characterized as the problematic legal arrangement, the right of Lindley Village Mobile Home Park owners to charge annual maintenance fees to the prepaid 99-year lessees of the lots, a legal arrangement which, in the words of the Chancellor, creates a perverse set of financial incentives that practically guarantees no cooperation in the maintaining of the community. A most fundamental reason for the existence and evolution of courts of equity in our history, the Chancellor noted, is the occasional but inevitable failure of the system of legal rights and duties to afford, quote, a sufficient remedy, unquote. The Chancellor proceeded to order the implementation of a governance framework modeled on the organization of condominiums and ordered the formation of the Lindley Membership Association, an appellee in this action, to represent the park lessees in financial matters. More than a decade later, the Court of Chancery brought closure to the failed Lindley Village experiment in long-term leases of mobile home lots by finding that the park owners validly decided to change the use of the park, validly sent notices of termination to the park lessees under 25 Del C, Section 7010, for the reasons set forth in the notices. In view of the failure of the statute to address the means of reimbursing tenants who have prepaid long-term leases, the Vice Chancellor noted, I will undertake to fashion a suitable compensation mechanic by reference to appropriate valuation methodologies and traditional means for securing performance of payment, thus forming bookends at either end of the Lindley Village litigation. We find the Court of Chancery discharging its jurisprudential responsibility by exercising its traditional equitable powers and discretion to fashion a needed remedy where none exists at law. Appellants contend that the Court of Chancery was not engaged in the exercise of its discretion in addressing the issue raised from the outset by the appellee park owners regarding the compensation to be paid to the prepaid long-term lessees upon termination. Rather, appellants contend they have the right to, quote, fair market value, unquote, of their leaseholds as defined by common law developed in public taking cases as of the very day of lease termination. What is the source of this perceived right? Is it constitutional, as in public taking cases? No. The lease terminations arose from the park owner's exercise of contractual rights established by statute, and of which the lessees had ample warning prior to their purchase of the leases. Is the perceived right to fair market value statutory? No. Is the perceived right established at common law? No. Appellants contend that the source of their perceived rights arise from what they call the, quote, law of the case, unquote, based on court musings about valuation as the court was in the process of informing itself about what it would adopt as an equitable compensation figure and the mechanics for securing it. Appellants accuse what they wanted the court to have ruled with what it actually ruled. If there is any doubt about the intentions of the court below, the court fully dispelled it when, with Mr. Abbott's emailed objections to the final order in hand, and that's in AR 24, and asked by the array of parties, now appellees, to phrase an order exactly as it wished, that's in AR 22, the court expressly stated that the appellee's wording regarding equitable compensation, quote, properly gives effect to the court's decision in this matter, unquote. That's on the last page of the appellant's opening brief. The court below realized that the park owners did not have the means to pay the termination compensation equitably due the lessees and insisted that the conveyance of the park, the payment of the money, and the necessary escrowing of funds and the payoff of lessee mortgages all had to function, in the words of the court, like the gears of a clock. The unworkability of appellant's proposal for a date of termination appraisal is twofold. One, the court below realized the complex multi-party real estate development transaction which the compensation funds would originate from, and the certainty of each party's obligations under that arrangement had to be clear to be bankable. While a player to be named later clause seems to work in the unique context of professional baseball trades, a price to be named later has no place in a sophisticated multi-party real estate development contract. Appellants seek the valuation of unique 99-year mobile home leaseholds as though it can be whipped out in a day. From the date of the order charging Lawrence Monahan in January 2004 to the date of the Monahan appraisal in May, to the hearing on the valuation in August 2004, and to the master's draft report at the end of the year in 2004, 11 months lapsed. The appraisal, the hiring of MAI appraisers, and the cost of appraisers appearing in the court cost close to $20,000. It is not a small enterprise. The park owners, incidentally, paid every dime of that sum. Appellants cite much ballyhooed evidence of price appreciation, but the transcript of the due cause hearing shows exactly what that evidence was. It was clippings advertising units for sale in parks outside of Lindley Village and listings of those types of units. Those were not the same units that Mr. Monahan evaluated. These are amenity-rich units that bear no resemblance whatsoever to Lindley Village uses. They are advertisements rather than actual sales. They were objected to as incompetent because they weren't the product of expert witnesses, and they were objected to on grounds of hearsay. To the hearsay objection, counsel for the appellants said, well, I'm introducing these not to show the value of those particular lots, but to show change of value. The court inexplicably accepted these documents in evidence, but obviously gave them their appropriate weight. Nothing. The appraisal that was ordered also is of importance. It is the contention of the appellants that the court was after a conclusion of fair market value so that that would be the award provided. There has never been an expression by the court that that was going to be the equitable compensation awarded. There were set-offs. There were all kinds of adjustments that were facing the court with respect to bulkheading and the dereliction of duties on the part of the plaintiffs alleged of the park owners, and the park owners alleged of the tenants. So what was equitable was a matter that the court was grappling with. Early on, after the first summary judgment award granted and affirmed the right of the park owners to terminate the leases, Mr. Rennie in an office conference asked, what about the issue of compensation? The vice chancellor said, Mr. Rennie, what is the value of a terminated lease? Is that the law of the case, that there's no value to a terminated lease? No. The court was working its way through, making its best judgment, gathering the facts, taking in evidence. There were two hearings with respect to this particular matter, and the court finally arrived at its final judgment. That final judgment happened to be one where the court decided that the settlement agreement arrived at by a number of the parties, the defect 83 of the 87 lots, the Lindley Membership Association, which had therefore, by majority vote, decided all such financial questions, and the park owners and the purchaser, the equitable owner of the park, all agreed. The vice chancellor reasoned through that and decided, for the reasons stated in his memorandum opinion of August, that that was the sum that he would decide was the equitable compensation. If there's no questions, I yield to Mr. Rennie.
May it please the court, Sheldon Rennie, Your Honors. I represent the plaintiffs below appellees in this matter. This case is simply about whether the Court of Chancery abused, as the standard that should be applied is an abuse of discretion, and whether the Court of Chancery abused that discretion in approving the settlement that was entered in below. Of course, my friend argues that it's a judgment as to whether the Court of Chancery erred as a matter of law. I think significant to this court's determination is the procedural history of this case as well as the facts. On October 10th, 2003, the Court of Chancery ruled that 25 Del Code Chapter 70 governed the 99-year leases at issue, and as such, the leases could be prematurely terminated. Significantly, despite the fact that Chapter 70 is silent on any compensation to be due to the appellees, plaintiffs below, the court said, I will fashion an appropriate remedy, even despite the fact that the statute itself was silent. The court had no obligation to fashion a remedy because the statute was silent. In fact, the court could have gone with the suggestion of the defendants below that a prorated amount of the $30,000 that was paid for as an upfront prepaid rent to be the compensation. The court could have gone with a second suggestion by the defendants that they be paid the $30,000. Instead, the court said, no, I will fashion a remedy, and in doing so, he commissioned an appraisal to be conducted. A significant flaw in the appellant's argument is the fact that they do not contest the fact that the amount assessed by the appraiser was fair market value at the time of the appraisal. They're arguing that it's now stale. They're not saying it was never fair market value. They're saying it's not fair market value today, and they're not basing that on any credible evidence. They included some clippings that suggest that the amounts have gone up since then. Another significant point, Your Honors, is the fact that at the time the appellants were joined with the plaintiffs, we argued successfully to the Court of Chancery that the appraisal date should be made effective as of the date of the appraisal, where the defendants were arguing that the appraisal date should be made effective 1 year prior, which was the date of notice of termination.
Say appraisal date, do you mean the amount of the appraisal?
No.
As of the date of the appraisal?
No, Your Honor. The, when I say appraisal date, I mean the date the appraisal was completed. The effective date of that appraisal would be May of 2004. The defendants argued that the effective date of the appraisal for the park, the value of the park, should be as of February of 2003, the date the notice went up. So we got an extra year, and at that time the appellants were part of the plaintiff's group, so we got an extra year of value, which we successfully argued to the Court of Chancery. Another significant issue is the appraiser came back with a value of $145,000, and this answers your Chief Justice's questions. $145,000 for the lots that fronted on the lagoon, and $195,000 for those that fronted on the creek. We were able to, after several negotiations with the purchaser as well as the defendants, come up with a value that exceeded the amount that the appraiser came up with. The high end of the appraisal was $160,000 and $210,000. The settlement that we agreed upon was not only $160,000 and $210,000, but it also included other perks such as payment for sewer fees, payment for maintenance fees, which was not included in the appraisal. It included payment of transfer taxes for each of the tenants so that they wouldn't have to pay that. It also included the ability of the tenants to remain in the park until they were paid.
They stayed for the balance of the time without additional rent.
Exactly, Your Honor. Another factor, as the Chief Justice asked, was whether we understood in negotiating the settlement that payment would take place at or about June of 2006. Absolutely yes, Your Honor. And that's why we negotiated for these additional benefits. I think it's significant that...
Now, will those additional benefits accrue to the four people who are objecting also?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. In fact, the payments will also be accrued, or they'll receive the benefits of the payment, the $160,000, and even though they didn't sign the settlement agreement.
Now, even if fair market value were the standard to be applied, and the date of determining fair market value was June 1st, 2006, is it significant that 83 of 87 of the tenants agreed to the numbers you just suggested as fair value as of June 1st, 2006?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it shows what the market was willing to pay or render as a value for what they determined their lease to be, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I see my time is up. If
Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
You have reserved time.
We have you down for 2 minutes. If you only want one, we'll negotiate.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Rabbit. I didn't mean to evict you there. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Peter Frattarelli from Archer & Greiner on behalf of intervener below, Caldera Properties. As has been testified or as has been indicated earlier, we hold the purse strings here. We're the purchaser here, the one who's funding the issue. And a couple of the points have already been addressed, so I only want to address just two brief points. First, Mr. Abbott indicated that you need a date certain, and that's certainly what my client believes. And when you're dealing with a one-home purchase, for example, you can certainly have an agreement of sale and a closing that may be 60 or 90 days out where you can agree on when the appraisal is going to be. This is not that type of transaction. You have 99-year leaseholds, which are unique to begin with. Beyond that, you have a complex transaction where we're converting it to a totally different use. So my client, as the developer here, certainly needed some certainty and needed some predictability, both in terms of the sales price, in terms of lining up lenders, and as was set forth in the stipulated order that led to the order to show cause, it was conditioned upon or was also subject to government approvals and county approvals. So, again, just the nature of this transaction requires a date certain, and not on the date of closing, not June of 2006 when we thought the process would be complete and we would be paying the money over. We need to have that date certain at the time this was established. And just to give you one example, the order itself provides that if it goes beyond June 1st of 2006, there's a payment made to the individual tenants for any additional delays. So if we apply for an extension, additional money is paid. So I think that from my client's perspective, certainly that is the key issue here. So just if the market value becomes soft, we are not entitled to go back and say, okay, we now want to give you 125, because in June 2006 or June 2007, the market has softened. So too should the tenants here be bound by the price that the judge believed was equitable compensation.
Thank you.
I'll follow up on a few of the points that were made. First, I wanted to point out that in the Lindley Village 2 decision rendered by the Court of Chancery, it expressly recognized that the difference in value, there was a substantial difference in value between 1988 and 2003. In fact, it expressly rejected the suggestion of the park owners that a proportional refund of amounts paid for the original lease purchase was appropriate, and pointed specifically to the evidence that the original purchase in 1988 was at $2 million and some change, and that the contract of sale that was entered into with Mr. Frattarelli's clients was for $7 million. In 2003, therefore reflecting a more than threefold increase in value. So it's clear, I think, that the court understood there is substantial appreciation being experienced in this marketplace. And the comment about the sale listings that were submitted, to be frank, the time period that was permitted to be able to give these submissions did not permit us to obtain an alternative appraisal. It usually takes 3 to 4 months. We did ask the court for additional time to possibly obtain an appraisal to present any further evidence, but those sale listings reflected a substantial likelihood, at least, of continued very high percentage of appreciation in the marketplace. If you look at Mr. Monahan's appraisal that was in the record, a Lindley Village sale just 11 months earlier before his effective date of value was increased by 18% based upon change in market condition. That's about 20% a year. So if you factor that in, and if that was continuing for the 25 months that are at issue in this case, that would lead to close to $60,000, even above the $145,000 number contained in Mr. Monahan's report. So that we're at $205,000. It's substantially above the $160,000 amount that was awarded. And to respond to the Chief Justice's queries about whether the settlement was indicative of fair market value, I would submit that, number one, typically, and I admittedly did not raise this in the court below, but typically settlement agreements are not allowed to be admitted into evidence at an evidentiary hearing. So in the normal course, if it was not already in the record, so to speak, by the rule to show cause order, I would submit that the settlement agreement would not even be admissible. But it was in the record at the time, but I would submit in the context of fair market value, as the Chief Justice noted, it's a willing buyer, willing seller. It has to be willing. The nature of a compromise eliminates the possibility that it's willing in this situation because it's compromise of contested litigation. And so therefore, I would submit that it is not indicative of a fair market value sale that would be admissible in its own right to show value. Fair market value, there's been a lot of dispute about whether that was the standard and that the Vice Chancellor never put it in any of his decisions, and that's true. However, he never used the term equitable compensation other than in the order that Mr. Frana drafted and he did sign, but that's not what the law of the case was preceding that date, certainly, and under the circumstances, the more important issue really is the date of value. It's not even so much fair market. We think it is fair market value, but the most important point is the effective date of value, which we believe, based on the court's prior rulings, has to be as of the date of the termination of the leases. And the rest, we believe, will follow in our favor. We also believe that even if you use the abuse of discretion standard, it doesn't pass muster, because that looks to whether there is substantial evidence and an orderly and deductive process. If you look at the record, there's really nothing there that the court could rely upon. And for a person, we don't believe it's reasonable to conclude that fair market value can be a two-year-old value. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.